Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. Last week, President Donald Trump was acquitted in the impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. Less than 2 hours after the vote, a conversation about impeachment was hosted at Arts United, featuring three speakers. Andy Downs, director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, Brian Francisco, senior copy editor and Washington editor for the Journal-Gazette, and WBOI news director Rebecca Green. Thanks to our friends at Advancing Voices of Women, or AVOW, AVOW has been hosting civil conversation events in Fort Wayne for over 2 years. Special thanks to Patty Hayes, Rachel Tobin-Smith, Marilyn Moran Townsend, and Faith Van Gilder for organizing AVOW events in our community. And special thanks to Luke Hollinger and his team at Arts United for providing audio for this program. Special thanks to John Dawkins for recording it. Patty Hayes was the MC for the event, and we'll hear from each of the panelists shortly, beginning with opening remarks from Andy Downs. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. We were rebelling. We've chosen not to sit. That's our first bit of rebelling. The second bit of rebelling is that I function under the assumption that you should answer the question you want to answer, not the question that was asked. You just need to be someplace in the neighborhood, and people may not realize you've done it. I have warned you of this now, so we will get started. And I'm going to start with a disclaimer. I am not an expert on impeachment, all right? So let's be clear about that. I'm not an expert on impeachment, and quite frankly, I'm not sure anyone can lay claim to that, given that we've only done this 3 times. So let's remember that as we move through. But I want to start a little further back. I actually want to start back when the current Constitution was adopted, because I was asked to comment on these sorts of things. Federalist Paper number 51 said that if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. What a wonderful thought. Unfortunately, we are human beings. We are the people who then govern ourselves. And the Founding Fathers said, you know what we need? What we need is a system that separates the power out and creates checks and balances so that no one can actually accumulate too much power, and even if they start to, another branch or something in one of the branches can begin to check that. And by the way, the third bullet, which is not up there, is that in the end, voters have their say. And so there was a firm belief on the part of the Founding Fathers that, number one, we may not be very smart, we the people. We may be susceptible to giving in to mob rule. We may join factions that work against the common good, but in the end, we are still the ones who should have the power. And so that's where, in some respects, we start. And for those of you who don't remember your three branches of government, of course, I brought a diagram from an intro textbook, which I think is incredibly unnecessary given this group, and a diagram that shows checks and balances. I show this to students, and inevitably my question becomes, any one of these checks and balances appear you don't know about? Because if I ask them if they know them, they give me the easy ones like veto. It's when I ask them what they don't know that we really find out where our conversation should go. I give hard exams, apparently. So here is quiz number one for you all. Ready? Quiz number one. Which branch of government is the most powerful branch? Who says that it is the legislative branch? Show of hands. Who says it's the executive branch? Show of hands. Who says it's the judicial branch? Show of hands. Who did not vote? What part of these three options did you not see up there? This is an optical scan test. You got to fill in one of those three bubbles. So once again, you got to pick one. Legislative branch. Lonely, lonely legislators out there. Executive branch. And then finally, judicial branch. Why?
Because they usually have the final say.
Final say. That's the answer I get most often. Legislative or the judicial branch, because they have the final say. And when I ask people why legislative branch, they say, hey, if there's no law, there's nothing to do. And the people who say executive branch, it's quite often they're the ones who actually get to execute the law. And what students understand is, for example, when a cop pulls you over and doesn't give you a ticket, That's the executive branch using some discretion. And we pick up tips for how to get out of tickets as well when we do this in class. So the answer, those of you who did not answer the first time I asked the question, why not? Because they're equal. That's the answer students want to give too, by the way. They always ask for option D. My answer is actually all of them and none of them. They are not equal. As much as we want to believe that, that's the simple understanding. The reality is that the amount of power that each one has fluctuates over time, and how you define power manages to influence your decision. So for example, the final say is the final say, therefore, power is about finality. For other people, if it doesn't exist, there's nothing to do, therefore, that's the most powerful thing. It varies from person to person. Next sort of pop quiz, I'm gonna lead you into the pop quiz question. You have heard the terms judicial activism and judicial restraint before? Yes, 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 okay. For those of you who have not, you've had a chance to read them. Activism, the philosophy that courts should move beyond the text of laws and the Constitution and consider broader social implications. Restraint, it's the philosophy that says don't look beyond the text. That's what you, originalists are restraint people. What did the founders mean when they wrote it? Okay, quick show of hands. Which is your point of view? How many of you are judicial activists? How many of you are restraint people? How many of you didn't vote this time? Blank answers count against you. I'm just telling you that right now when I'm scoring this out. Blank answers count against you. Those of you who did not vote, why not?
Sometimes judicial restraint.
And you know what's interesting? If you look throughout time, judicial activist, that's a slur. It's a slur. If you have decided against what I think the law says, you're an activist judge. So Democrats have called Republicans that, Republicans have called Democrats that. We have these different opinions. So it's interesting. Some would say, well, that's not fair. That's ad hoc theory. You need to pick a philosophy and stick with it. Don't rationalize your decision making. That's all you're doing when you do that. So then what are high crimes and misdemeanors? This is an open-ended question. This is a short answer question this time. It's no A, B, C on this one. What are high crimes and misdemeanors? You're it.
I don't know.
I don't know. Anybody else? Anybody had thought about these beforehand? I'm going to ask one of our attorneys here.
Yeah, they're high crimes and misdemeanors are not criminal necessarily, but it's high crimes and misdemeanors. The original draft of the Constitution was against the United States. And so it's actions that violate the public trust of we the people for the United States.
Now, here's what I did. Since I am not an expert on impeachment, I contacted an expert on the Constitutional Convention, not the Constitution itself or judicial meaning of these terms. And this is basically the exchange I had with him. Hey, what did the Founding Fathers mean when they said high crimes and misdemeanors? And he said they never defined it. What I didn't put up there was he said, of course. They intended it as a more specific prohibition than maladministration, which is a term they actually spent a lot of time discussing. Maladministration. Not, I disagree with your perspective, but you're running the country wrong. You are doing something to the detriment of the country, not just a decision about policy. And then he went on to say that there actually was a very long and rigorous debate about elections and what elections are supposed to mean and the purpose of elections. But in spite of the fact that everybody agreed, yes, the election is the final say, there's the reality that no, someone could do something during a term that would justify getting kicked out. And this was then followed by me saying, so the Founding Fathers were just winging it, weren't they? And he said, yes, by September they were. They were kind of tired by then, so there's a lot of stuff that just got crammed in, and you sort of lose some of the beautifulness of the Constitution when you talk with people who study it, because they're like, yeah, by the end of it, they were just throwing stuff together in ways that did not make sense. He did say, hey, you might want to check out these websites, though. If you're looking for the actual debate about the Constitutional Convention, or in the convention specifically about high crimes and impeachment, these are the two sources you need to check out. I will, of course, send them to somebody like Patty, who will then send them around to you. You have in front of you a piece of paper that actually has on it what the Constitution says. It is really brief. It lacks detail in so many ways, which is both good and bad, right? It means that we can adapt over time, and at the same time, doesn't give us much direction. So for example, House of Representatives shall have sole power to impeach. The Senate, sole power to try all impeachments. End of story. Doesn't say what those meetings are supposed to look like. Doesn't say that there should be witnesses or not, evidence or not. It's you get to impeach, you get to try the impeachment. End of story. There are some more specifics when you actually look in Article 2, and you will see, for example, that if we're going to kick you out, it's got to be for high crimes and misdemeanors. There's going to have to be a two-thirds vote in the Senate in order for that to happen. These are the specific words. This is it. The way we go about doing it is very much up to the individuals who are in the office. And there we start to run into some trouble. Because, as we were told, we ain't angels. We may not have the best motivations in our lives. If you're looking for the visual representation of what the Constitution says, here it is. But it doesn't change the fact that as individuals, we may choose to do bad things. Things that are not motivated by the common good, but instead motivated by our political ambitions. And that can happen on both sides of the aisle. It doesn't have to be limited to one perspective or another. So here is where this leaves us, as far as I'm concerned. Do not forget there's a political element to impeachments. There always is. Politics is nothing more than a fight over scarce resources. It's how we decide who gets what, when, and how. That's what politics is. We are all politicians. We all engage in the behavior. We criticize elected officials. The fighting over scarce resources, we do a lot of the same things, let's say, that the elected officials do. Second, it's not a court of law. So when people say, this has been handled, if this were a court, this would have been handled differently. Yeah, because it would have been a court. It is not the same thing. It's like people who say, I'm going to run government like a business. Well, government's not a business. It doesn't work. Third, everyone can find something in the history of impeachment, in the way the Clinton impeachment was done, the Johnson impeachment was done, you can find something somewhere in there or in the Constitution that backs up your position. So, for example, the people who were saying, we need witnesses, they said, look at Clinton, says we need witnesses. Other people said, we don't need witnesses, Constitution doesn't say we have to have them. So why should we have them? We should only have them if we think they will bring more information. I have all the information I need. And so people are able to rationalize their position. And then keep in mind, there are 435 individuals, or 100, depending on which part of this process you're talking about, who are going to have different views about things, different ways of handling the situation, who are motivated by different things, who see things differently, restraint versus activism. How much do we need to worry about the checks and balances? Do they believe there is some imbalance now in the system or in the separation of powers, etc.? And then finally, of course, the Founding Fathers were right. Regardless of what those 535 people do, regardless of whether it looks more like a trial than not, regardless of whether we think things were done for politically motivated reasons or not, you and I get to have our say. And our say comes at the ballot box at some point. And that may explain, in part, why we have seen impeachments only when folks were not going to be running for re-election. Because the idea was, those are folks for whom there was no recourse for the voters. And on that note, I will put up what I consider to be a nice holding page, and I will turn it over to Brian.
Thank you, Andy. Just for anybody who has been asleep today and doesn't know, Donald Trump was not convicted. He was acquitted by the Republican Senate, so spoiler alert there. Patty had asked me to talk about the changing media landscape during impeachments, and then she proceeded to take my presentation. So my 10 or 15 minutes will be considerably shorter. But however, I do think that a great example of how the media landscape has changed came at last night's State of the Union address, where President Trump presented the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Rush Limbaugh in Congress at the State of the Union address. That was the first time that that's ever happened at a State of the Union address. It was the first time, because it's delivered in Congress, that a Medal of Honor has ever been presented in Congress. It's usually done at the White House. Rush Limbaugh certainly is not the first opinion columnist. We've had William Buckley has got a Presidential Medal of Freedom, William Sapphire. There have been any number of media people, Walter Cronkite, Tom Brokaw, Ben Bradley of the Washington Post, and Katherine Graham, which interestingly, Katherine Graham was given it by George W. Bush, and then Ben Bradley was given the medal by President Obama. So there was some bipartisanship going on there. But Rush Limbaugh is perhaps, he made his name during the Clinton White House years. Talk radio, I believe he started in the late 1980s, but he really came to the forefront in the 1990s with the Republican Revolution, when Republicans took back control of the U.S. House for the first time in 40 years. While they called it the Republican Revolution, there were people that called it the Limbaugh Congress. And Rush Limbaugh became a very prominent commentator on the radio in those days and was instrumental in calling for President Clinton's impeachment, saying that he had broken the trust of the American people, and very, it was probably a nice way of saying how he described President Clinton. And of course, he's become one of the biggest cheerleaders for President Trump. So he is a lightning rod on the right and left. And today, in fact, a columnist or opinion writer in the Washington Post, Paul Waldman, wrote a column just hours ago saying that really President Trump is a creation of Rush Limbaugh, that many of the themes that Trump has hit on for the last 3 years have been coming from Limbaugh since the late 1980s. Now then, we've got talk radio is still very popular. How did you find out about Rush Limbaugh's, the acknowledgement that he has lung cancer? I don't know about you, I found about it online. Increasingly, even though we have it in the newspaper this morning, increasingly we are getting, whether it's the newspaper online or other news sources, we're increasingly going online to get our information. So I found out about Rush Limbaugh's cancer online. The internet in Bill Clinton's presidency was very young. You were getting your information from newspapers, magazines, radio, television, and as Patty was saying, the television landscape had changed tremendously. You had, CNN had been around for a long time, but you had MSNBC and Fox News had just emerged. But those networks were nothing like they are today as far as their political partisanship. CNN is considered mostly in the middle, MSNBC on the left, Fox on the right. Now think back to Nixon, and you had no cable TV, no internet. People depended on newspapers. But again, your lasting recollection, as great a job as the Washington Post did, Woodward and Bernstein exposing the Watergate Hotel burglary and the Nixon administration's cover-up of that, probably your lasting recollection of that time was from television. Actually, and you only had four networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS, were breaking into their regular programming during the day. People were up in arms because their soap operas, their game shows, were being preempted. I believe PBS, though, showed it around the clock. They preempted all their regular programming. They didn't have many game shows on PBS. So there you had television really came into its own. People remember John Dean testifying in the Watergate hearings. And, of course, Nixon resigned before the impeachment ever came to a vote in the House. And then we can go all the way back to Andrew Johnson in 1868. And, of course, you only had newspapers and magazines in those days. But there had been rapid technological change in that time. Newspapers in the 1700s and early 1800s had always been affiliated with political parties, and many of them had been mouthpieces for political parties. In the 1840s, with the advent of telegraph, you started having newspapers were able to get information from around the country in a matter of minutes, even if it took them overnight to print and publish their editions. You had intense competition. You had the penny papers, Horace Greeley, all the rise of competition among newspapers. But as opinionated as they were, you had a big change with the Civil War in that people wanted facts and not opinions. And the public, there was a public outcry that the Civil War be reported as hard news so they could find out what was happening, who was winning, who was being killed. And that carried over into Andrew Johnson's impeachment. So all four, and I know Nixon was not impeached, but he resigned before he could be, all four impeachments have had very different media landscapes. And I have no research or scientific knowledge of this, but I think it does change our perception that the type of media that we receive changes our perception. Even today, are you getting your information on the Trump impeachment from Fox, from MSNBC, from the newspaper, from the radio, from Facebook, on Twitter? You know, I'm finding out today how our congressman feels about Mitt Romney's vote to convict Trump for abuse of power on Twitter. And increasingly, that's the way you have communications from your elected officials. So it has been a rapid change in technology and media coverage since Clinton, and it'll be interesting to see the next impeachment, if it is a big change, although there are some people that are already saying that if Biden's elected, he will be impeached. So it may be sooner than later. And with that, I'll give it over to Rebecca.
So I was a baby in utero probably during the Nixon impeachment. So maybe that's what happened. My mom watched a lot of political television. Just kind of absorbed it. In the late 90s, I was in a summer journalism internship program in D.C. during the Clinton impeachment. And I remember every day walking past Ken Starr's hearings with trucks and satellite trucks and just kind of experiencing that. So I've been around three in some fashion. So I work now for WBOI, for those of you, and I'm assuming most of you in this room are familiar with us. We are the NPR affiliate. We are a nonprofit. NPR and PBS are not corporate media. While we do have underwriters, we are not selling advertising on our stations. We are funded largely by the public, by membership and donations. And because we are a 501c3, we do not endorse candidates. We do not publish opinion pieces. Even if, for those of you who remember the late Cokie Roberts, she bordered on opinion every now and then, and they would have to tell her to stop. That's not our model. Our model, as Ron Elving said a couple years ago when he was here in town, is more democracy. More access to information helps with more democracy. The more you know, the more information that you have, the better informed you are, and the easier it is for you to participate and keep our democracy solid. It's a lovely idea. And I think in large part it does work. At WBOI, we made the decision very early on in the impeachment process to air all of it. How many of you, anybody in here, listened to any of it on WBOI? Thank you. Some stations within the Indiana Public Broadcasting Network did not. We made that decision because we felt, much like back in the Nixon impeachment, it was important for people to have access to it unfiltered. There was commentary from NPR's political reporters and political commentators, but not, it wasn't filtered. You mentioned Fox and Rush Limbaugh. One of the things I think when we talk about civility, we have to acknowledge that as the media landscape has continued to fragment, that access has fragmented and become distorted. To contrast public broadcasting's approach to impeachment, Fox aired the impeachment trial in the Senate with no sound. There were many evenings when they aired only video of the House managers and their own commentators telling their listeners and their viewers what they saw. That is contrary to the public model. That is contrary to probably a healthy approach, because you as American citizens need the information. We need to trust you enough to give you the information so that you can make those decisions. When I teach my journalism class, one of the things I tell my students, the first thing to appear when a society transitions from closed to open is a free press. It could be underground pamphlets, it could be things on a bulletin board, but free expression of information, a constant need to know what is going on. One of the first things that disappears when a society transitions from open to closed is the diminishment of that freedom. So for me, as a journalist, whether it was at the newspaper or now with WBOI, that access to information, that access to all of it is key. So we can't really talk about civility without talking about information. And part of the problem with, I don't know how to phrase this, so you have, when people are afraid of something, right, they become angry. That's often our first reaction. So when you have people who are afraid of information that may contradict their views, they become angry and defensive. So for those of us in the media trying to give information, we want to make sure that we remain as calm and neutral and unbiased and open as possible, because more information is more democracy. Pew Research Center just did a study on A Nation Divided, on the U.S. media and the path to the 2020 election. Two-thirds of Republicans say they trust Fox as a source. That same cohort trusts the New York Times only 10%. So you're dealing with people who are afraid now of institutional media, and that's a problem. So I think if I were going to have you take anything away tonight, it's to share with those who you know who might be afraid of those conversations that information is necessary, that it's the currency of freedom. So NPR, we try to stay in the middle. There's algorithms out there that have determined, however they do, that NPR's coverage is literally right in the middle of the box. I'm proud of that fact. We try to hold that line here in Fort Wayne in Northeast Indiana at WBOI, because information matters, and quality information, even though facts sometimes appear partisan, they're necessary.
Is Twitter the ultimate freedom of speech? No one filters. Brian, you said you got to find out directly what your senator thought about Romney's vote.
I don't know if you can define the ultimate freedom of speech. You know, there's the old saying that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. We're seeing people yell fire in a crowded theater all the time these days, figuratively. Rebecca is talking about factual reporting. We are now questioning what is fact and what is fiction. And different sides have different interpretations. So you're free to, you have freedom of speech, you have freedom to be wrong, and freedom to believe you're wrong, I guess.
One of the things, and I touched on this a little bit, that kind of fracturing of the media, the news back in the 80s, 60s, 70s was not terribly diverse. It was white guys at 5:30 or 6:30 telling you, this is what happened today. It was largely white men going out and getting and gathering that information. I don't know that that was the best way, but at that time there was a consistency of fact and a consistency of experience. Now, at that time, it was, did you prefer Peter Jennings or Tom Brokaw? And now you're picking the smorgasbord and the ability to curate your media diet is very interesting and very dangerous. I tend to be a little more comfortable with Twitter in some ways than some people probably are. I think Twitter in some ways is less dangerous even than Facebook, because Twitter is kind of more freeform and Facebook does a little more aggressive curating of what's in your newsfeed. But it's a different way of consuming news, and there's no filter. So if you're not savvy enough and educated enough, and I don't mean by books, but by awareness of what's going on around you, what's going on in your government, to recognize that this statement that this person just made is incorrect, there's a problem.
I want to echo something Rebecca said. Twitter is a delivery mechanism. It's a tool.
Yeah.
It's not free speech in and of itself. What you say is about free speech. Twitter's a delivery mechanism. And it's great that we now have a greater opportunity to do that. But as Brian pointed out, the idea of objective reporting of facts, talk about that in terms of the Civil War, the Columbia School of Journalism, sort of the gold standard, I would argue, of journalism, started in 1910, something like that. I mean, we're closing in on like 100 years of trained professional journalists who we, for the most part, have been relying on to tell us whether that thing was right or wrong that was being said. Now, because of Twitter, you and I have to figure that out. And for some people, they may not take the time to do it. They may not understand the ways to do it. And if they find somebody particularly witty or entertaining, why not just believe what they said instead of actually looking it up?
This is more of a nuts and bolts question than anything else, but there have been, I think, 15 or so impeachments of federal officials over the course of our history. That's, you know, congressmen, senators, judges, presidents. And only a half a dozen have ever been convicted. Number one, are all impeachments, even of lower level federal officials, conducted in the same freeform fashion? And number two, once you're impeached, you know, and convicted, of the half a dozen that have been convicted, are they immediately escorted from the building the way you are if you're fired?
Couple, out they go.
Yeah, they call human resources, they take away your password, shut down your account. It's ugly. You see the language. Because we have had more of them for judges than anything else, those have become to a degree somewhat standardized, because there's usually a very specific issue, one that can almost be, I don't want to say quantified, or that we can look at them over time and say, okay, we've now established this precedent that A, B, and C is impeachable. Part of the difference when you're talking about a president is there's only one, and it's someone who was chosen by the people, whereas judges are not. And that makes a pretty significant, and it's somebody who is eligible for getting kicked out by the people. And so that's part of the difference. But while there may be a bit of a structure, it's still fairly, I'll call it loose, for lack of a better term.
I have a question for each of you. So Andy, we'll start with you, a founding father's question. Alan Dershowitz presented what I thought was an incredibly novel and ultimately successful defense of the presidency, with this concept that if you are doing something in order to get yourself reelected and you believe that is in the public interest, that it cannot be impeachable. So I'd like to know from you what you think the founding fathers would have thought of that argument.
Given that the founding fathers were actually talking about maladministration, I think it's safe to say that that statement, as a broad statement, would be wrong, because it's conceivable somebody could be president who believes their reelection is right, and engages in an activity that is generally viewed as absolutely wrong and in the bad interest of the country, because they may not be, just because it's right in your mind does not mean it's right. The Founding Fathers recognized that. They talked about the common good. Dershowitz's argument was an interesting one, and one that I would have trouble with a student using that as justification, because it means nothing's ever wrong then, which is the fundamental problem with that thinking. I can do whatever I want. I can, to quote the president for a moment, shoot somebody on Fifth, and it will be okay because it's in the best interest. In fact, you know what? I will shoot the Democratic nominee because it's in my best interest, and what I want is correct. That's the extension of that logic. So I would argue the Founding Fathers would say incredibly flawed, and I would argue that was not what made senators vote against kicking him out of office. So I don't see that as the linchpin of the entire case. If it was, wow.
Brian, I've got a question for you. I'm a fan of all of the comedy channels in the evening, late night, and you didn't mention them as a media source. But the thing that I'm...
Marilyn, that's a good point. I'm glad you did that.
Yeah, the thing I'm particularly struck as I watch any of the comedy shows is that they will play some of the most preposterous and outlandish quotes, obviously right now from Trump, but from, you know, for years from whoever. And I've often thought that if those quotes were played by the general media, the general public would have a far different view of their political leaders.
Several years ago, a lot of people, there were studies done about this, especially among young people, more and more people in their 20s and 30s were getting their news from The Daily Show when Jon Stewart was the host of it. Mm-hmm. And he became kind of the standard bearer for the late night comedy show that would tackle very serious issues, but do it satirically and, you know, with a gut punch. And you've seen that bleed over into other areas. I don't think people who grew up on Johnny Carson could never have envisioned that Stephen Colbert would be able to get away with 20 minutes a night bashing Trump and his administration. Johnny Carson would throw a few very wholesome jokes about Governor Reagan. But so now this has gone mainstream, or lamestream, as Rush Limbaugh would say. And it has become an important part of the media landscape. And more people now are, because of technology, that the way news is delivered, are watching this on streaming devices. They're not necessarily staying up and watching it every night. So it doesn't have to have the immediacy that it used to have. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think that's another part of that media landscape that we certainly didn't have during the Clinton impeachment or during Nixon's days.
And I'd like to add to that, some of those same studies that showed that people of a certain age were getting their news from that. Similar studies were done doing content analysis. There actually were episodes of The Daily Show with more fact-based information in them than some of the full broadcast, conventional broadcast news. So, I mean, Stewart took the job very seriously for a comedian.
Finally, a question for Rebecca. That I know NPR particularly wrestled with this, and I'm not sure the media has settled this issue about whether or not to actually call a lie a lie.
I don't know that we have either. I have my views about that. For those of you who don't know my job before WBOI, I was a crime reporter for the Journal Gazette for a number of years, and my default is the facts. And some things, you know, the earth is round. Anyone saying that the earth is flat is not telling the truth. I don't know. I think they've moved a little closer to saying lie now. And part of the reason is that, much like the media doesn't get to declare a person killing another person a homicide or a murder, that is illegal. Those are legal definitions. To say something is a lie is a not necessarily just a moral question. It gets to motive. And if a person is telling you something, if a person really believes that the earth is flat, are they lying to you? Or are they confused, delusional, operating under some kind of other thought, if that makes sense? So when Rush Limbaugh says something that is patently untrue, or Donald Trump says something that is verifiably false, like we're protecting pre-existing conditions, even though we are actively suing to remove that provision from the ACA, is that a lie? I have my opinion. I'm sure you all do as well. But is it the job of the journalist to say that, or just to say, while Trump said we're protecting pre-existing conditions, comma, the Department of Justice is actually actively pursuing the ending of that provision? So you have to know motive more than most journalists are comfortable doing. I don't know if that answered your question, but...
But I want to ask the two journalists up here then, which is better from a public understanding of issue standpoint, to simply say that's a lie, or to say Trump administration said this while the DOJ is doing that?
More is better. I think part of the problem is that our attention span is so small, and, you know, a print reporter has an indefinite amount of space to explain that, while it might be very difficult for an NPR reporter on a 45-second newscast news story versus a 3-minute newscast or news magazine feature. So you do the best you can, but more is better. I have often wondered if we would be in this position we're in right now politically if, when he was campaigning, Donald Trump, comma, the thrice divorced reality TV star with 9 bankruptcies, comma, is also on the Republican ballot. Information, more information is better.
Now you see why Trump wants to defund NPR.
We can find Ukraine on a map.
Got a question here.
Yeah, my question is either to Brian or Rebecca, since they're newspaper and radio. Before I ask you the question, I got to tell you, I'm a totally free speech, no censorship. I don't believe in censorship in any way. But I am disappointed in the fact that in 2016, when Donald Trump came down the escalator and announced his candidacy for presidency and ended up in the, oh, by the way, I don't like Hispanics either. There was no follow-up to that at all. It was like he was just a joke that was going to go away. And I think the press and media in itself let the people down in the fact that there's a lot of people that like to dig for the news and are more responsible. But for people that actually don't have time for that, I mean, nothing was mentioned about his connection to, say, Roy Cohn or his his racial suit with his dad and all that. And it just let it ride till it snowballed, and it was totally out of control. And everybody that liked him didn't even know, by the time the election came around, that we're going to vote for him, didn't even know that a president can't take an amendment off the Constitution. You know, and Hillary didn't let anybody know that either. So it was, I think a lot of times the press just rode along. I don't know if it's because you're not owned independently anymore, you have other people to listen to, but I mean, and I don't expect this to happen. There are no more Walter Cronkites, there are no more Edward R. Murrow, so somewhere along the line, it has to be responsible reporting that doesn't look at the bottom line all the time.
I think Trump was actually treated as a novelty for several months. Now, but he did get a lot of media attention. In fact, there were complaints by other Republican candidates in 2016 that especially the morning shows, Morning Joe, and the Fox shows and everybody else, he was getting more time than all the other candidates combined. And it was because they knew he was going to say outrageous things.
There were a lot of investigations. There were tons of articles written about his questionable real estate transactions, the way money moved through his casino. There were lots of stories in the New York Times and the Washington Post and NPR and Politico and BuzzFeed and all of these places. And again, it's hard to know where to look for that. But if people don't have a lot of time, you're exactly right. And I was going to say exactly what Brian said. If you don't have a lot of time to go read those articles and you're getting ready in the morning and Morning Joe is on your TV in the background and this guy calls in and you remember him from The Apprentice, the information is out there. I think part of our problem now is that we have a society that's not conditioned anymore to look into it and take it all in and digest it and then make an opinion. It's just a lot easier to remember that guy on the Macy's commercial and with Martha Stewart and The Apprentice.
Okay. I'm so happy you keep reminding me of all these things. I forgot about the Macy's commercial. If there is an error, I will call it, in the interest of not calling something a lie, if there is a lie, if there's an error, is there a correction that also follows it? Which is also a part of the commitment. We all make mistakes. The question, in some respects, is what do we do after we make a mistake?
This is always the best part. I mean, what we're trying to do is questions that are going to give all of us the information that will help us have the engaging table conversations. So I give you those guidelines and ask you to ask your question.
Full panel question. How do you believe or think that the obscene money that we have flowing into our political system and the influence of special interest groups is affecting all forms of the media, from print, Twitter, to cable news?
I have a public broadcasting does not take political advertising, period, full stop. We will not air a commercial for whomever the Democratic nominee is. We will not air a commercial for the president. We will not do that. That's not what we do. So we do our best to not be influenced by that. And I know that in print, it's also not a particularly ad-friendly political ad. Like, you might see an ad, but you also see a different ad, maybe for another candidate. Brian can speak to that more. Andy can speak to that more. So I think that particular phenomenon, the dark money funding ads, that is a commercial television and commercial radio phenomenon. And the internet.
I think Julie and I would love to see these campaigns throwing some money the newspaper's way. It's every election cycle, I get contacted by candidates that I cover who say, here's our latest TV commercial if you want to write about it, or I want to make a statement on my opponent's TV commercial. And I will half seriously say, why don't you run it in the Journal Gazette and then we'll talk? Because we end up spending a lot of our time in print, and this is done all across the country, of arguing over how factual candidates' TV ads are. And you don't see any TV stations arguing about how factual print ads are. But that's just the nature of the beast.
When it comes to political campaigns, you do not have to have the most money in order to win, but you have to have enough money to win. And the more money that's spent, the higher the amount is for you to have enough money. What we've seen in Indiana in 2018, 2016, to a lesser degree years before that, was a tremendous escalation in the number of dollars spent here, to the tune of, I believe in 2018, it was about $50 million in the Senate race. Not just by the two major party candidates, including the primary contest, but also the outside groups that spent money. In the end, campaign finance laws are supposed to help you and me as voters know where did the money come from and how did you spend it. That's what it's supposed to do. The reality is that a lot of outside money spends time tearing down the opponent for two reasons. Number one, it still works. If it didn't, it wouldn't get used. Number two, it's an organization that can stop existing and there's no, in some respects, no human being behind it who you and I might get upset with. You think about a race for city council or mayor, we know those people. And if we don't like what someone did and we run into them in the grocery store or at a restaurant, we can say, I'm very disappointed in what you did. A group from another state run by someone we don't know, we can never have that experience. So they have, in some respects, free rein to spend the negative money. If you go to opensecrets.org, which actually tracks money in federal elections, you can see that outside money is spent unbelievably disproportionately in negative advertising, which then causes the campaigns to have to respond to the negative advertising in addition to delivering their own message, which of course drives the cost up. And it really gets to the point where it's impossible to imagine running for office without access to millions of dollars. It was pointed out to me on Sunday that I'm not as young as I used to be, although I still like to think of myself as young. I was not offended at all by the person who said that to me. I can remember when, if you had $1.25 million, you were a legitimate statewide candidate in Indiana. That doesn't get you in the door any longer. You need to be able to raise $15, $20 million now, and that's insane.
Andy, I'd like to ask you a follow-up on that. What will Michael Bloomberg's self-funded campaign do to the outside money?
It's definitely going to drive it up. There's no doubt about it. When I say you have to have enough money, that's no matter what role you're trying to play. If you and I decided to form an outside group and we wanted to spend money to defeat Rebecca, we would only need the amount necessary. Hey. Sorry about that. We would only need the amount necessary to defend her. When Bloomberg starts talking about spending, you know, $300 million, I think it is already, or $1 billion or $2 billion, every outside group has to spend in some version of an equivalency in order to have the effect.
So we're just going to see an escalation.
Oh, you betcha. Yeah. Until voters say no more.
So you don't think, like, the huge conglomerates that own the media corporations put money into campaigns?
Corporations make contributions to campaigns all the time, but there are limits, there are legal limits in what they can do. Same with the individuals who make contributions to campaigns. That does not mean that there is not influence from them. There certainly is. Where you see a greater chance for that is in what we refer to as the outside money, because there it's easier to give money to those organizations and not be scrutinized the way it is to get, you know, to write a check to Rebecca's campaign for county commissioner. Is that what we're citing? Whatever she's running for.
Sure.
For county sheriff. County sheriff, that's better.
There we go.
County sheriff. If I write a check to her, you're going to see it. If I write a check to Rebecca Sucks for Sheriff, some group outside the state, you will have a hard time finding that. And the transparency is really part of the issue. That's part of what Open Secrets tries to do with showing you where the money came from and where it was spent.
I have something I wanted to kind of just piggyback a little bit on this gentleman over here. I think about, you know, the media talking about stuff, the Hastings gentleman, that judge, and as bad as he is, you know, we didn't hear enough of him in the media about him now in the, what you said, the Senate. He's in the Senate now. How was he able to do that? And number two, he's mentioned about Hillary, that she didn't talk about a lot of bad stuff that Trump was doing running against him. And I think she didn't do that because she didn't want to say his name. But still, why didn't the media say enough about that? And the main thing, if President Obama was saying some of the things that Trump has said, would he have been president? And for certain, while in office, if he said or did any of that, would he not be impeached, and would he not be underneath the jail by now? I mean, I'm just wondering.
One of the dangers, I think, of the current moment, and I'm not going to speak to what really happened back then, because I'm just a news director at the local public radio affiliate. But I think we have a blizzard of information, and we have a blizzard of incidents, which is a word we hate in journalism because incidents is very non-specific. But there's been so much that's gone on, right? Like, even before the current administration took office, there was still so much. And because we have so much access to so much information, we're all really tired. And so some people cannot afford, they don't have the bandwidth to understand the impact of maybe what they're reading or what's being presented to them. And I don't just think it's a, I don't think it's completely a failure of the media. I think it's just kind of a failure of where we are as a culture right now, because everybody's pooped. You know, you're worn out by what's going on in your own life, and then you're being asked to keep up with all of this stuff. How many things happened today? I don't even know. And I'm a news director. Like, I literally am paid to watch the news and listen to the news and read the news all day. and I miss things because it's just relentless. So I think be kind to yourself and be kind to your neighbor who might be tired, and that might be why they're not as informed or as aware. They might just not have the bandwidth for it right now. And I don't know if that answered your question at all, and I'm not trying to equivocate, but that's kind of where I fall with it.
One thing that I find fascinating, and it's related to your question, was that in previous impeachments, Nixon and Clinton were both extremely secretive. And that's one of the reasons why they were in such trouble. Nixon, it came out during efforts to impeach him, his secret enemies list. Trump is just the opposite. He has been out front and open. He released the partial transcript of the phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky. And I don't know if he has advisors that were telling him this, or if he's just doing it on his own, but he has been, compared to Nixon and Clinton, very transparent, and basically said, here, I did it, now you interpret what I did. I say it was a perfect phone call. And so he's left it open for the interpretation, certainly of Congress, but also of voters. And it's just something that we never saw from either Clinton or Nixon.
Very quickly, people do get treated differently. Gary Hart, one photo with a woman on a boat, out, done. Today, very different than there. Number two, I always tell people when they say to me, oh, who's gonna win the election? They ask me, who's gonna win the election? And I tell them, political scientists are not good at predicting, but we're good at explaining. So you have to let me come back and tell you why I'm wrong when it's over. And unfortunately, hindsight's 20/20. We can all see things now and say, well, that should have been covered more, this should have happened there. I mean, if you ask me, I will tell you Hillary Clinton did not campaign nearly enough in Michigan, and that was the beginning of the end, as far as I'm concerned.
Several of you have alluded to people being tired, which is surely true. I'm worn out. But it bothers me that people don't take the extra step to understand history or to actually find out if something is factual or to expand on their knowledge. Now, I know part of that is my age, because I grew up with encyclopedias where you're looking at something that starts with C and you see something else and you just kind of, it piques your interest, you know? And you don't have that with Facebook and so forth. So I just, you know, you're talking about Fox and so forth. It just doesn't seem, and I don't know that you all can make a change, but it seems like we need to encourage people to expand their horizons a little bit. You know, here's the topic, but you go off and kind of figure out what you think about it. Am I making any sense?
Actually, let me make a quick comment. Today in class, Intro to American Politics class, I was talking with students about civil rights, and I did not just say Brown versus Board of Education, there, that's enough. I actually talked about a couple of court cases from the 1930s where people wanted to go to law school, but separate but equal was still the way we did things. The students, of course, said, well, this is just flat out wrong. And I would say, okay, I understand your position. Tell me how you think the people who made this decision got to their decision. I forced them into that box. And they were like, well, I don't want to do that. And I said, but this is part of learning, being able to see things from another perspective. Why would paying the tuition for an African American go to law school in another state, why is that acceptable? Why is it acceptable to create a law school for one student, all the same profs, meets at night, no other students in it? Why is that acceptable under the thought of separate but equal? It was easy for them to tell me why it was wrong. I asked them why someone could have thought it was right. That's part of the challenge we face today. How do you see things from another perspective? Part of what I like about the civil conversations and about deliberation in general is the idea that for a moment we're going to listen to someone else and for a moment try to understand that position. We may still disagree in the end, but at least we're going to try to do that. That's the magic of good deliberative democracy. That's the magic of living in a society with people who are not exactly like you or me.
We have two more questions, and that our experts will stay and go around the table, so you'll get another chance to ask your question if you didn't get to.
Just quick, I had a disclaimer that said I wasn't an expert right at the start of this. Just pointing that out, Rachel. Just. Hi.
Thank you. I think Fort Wayne is blessed with multiple media, and I've worked with many of y'all. You do a yeoman's job in a dwindling market. The General Gazette, giving space to the New Sentinel. I just thank all of you for doing that, plus NPR. When I was in working with the State Department in 1973 in Turkey, we got the news on a Saturday night of the Saturday night massacre. I was in the room with a bunch of media people who said, what the hell is going on in the United States? Why is this a problem? So much of the time, we had to deal with American events through our foreign media. The State Department was very, very slight in what they were saying about what was going on for official reasons. So when I take a look at media here, I'm amazed at how some of these phalange little reporters, who otherwise generally aren't regarded well, will pick up on a story that you can go research. And especially I appreciate NPR pulling in BBC. BBC has an incredibly diverse input. And the biggest thing I have to say is these events in the United States have powerful influence overseas. And just thinking about news that we saw in Turkey back in 1973 and how that all ended up. The media can best try to find stories, and if they sound crazy, look at it. And, you know, all of us need to find many, many different ways of looking into any event.
Related to that, I want to encourage people to go looking for other sources. Obviously, listen to NPR, read the Journal Gazette. I have a 50-year relationship with the Journal Gazette, including 5 years delivering your fine product. 4:30 in the morning, every morning, 7 days a week, I want to point out. But for me, I mean, I don't speak a second language. I have enough trouble with English. But BBC, RTE, CBC, there are English language radio stations available. And when it says this is their world report, hey, that means they're talking about us because, you know, that's local for them and we're world for them. Please seek that stuff out. It is incredibly interesting to hear the different perspective. Even if you end up on an editorial show where they're making commentary as opposed to reporting fact, it's fascinating. And sometimes the reports are really elementary because they have to explain to people what a caucus is because they don't do that. So you get this nice explanation of what a caucus is. Please seek out other sources. I know it will make you tired. But if you have enough variety, the variety helps to sort of keep you up a little bit and maybe not wear you out quite as much.
So that's actually the perfect segue for my question. I was going to ask Rebecca, you mentioned that information is the currency of freedom. And taking that metaphor a step further, you know, you're saying more is better. Is there ever an extreme in which the value of that currency is inflated and therefore devalued, where this overabundance of information is so overwhelming that people just check out? Or what concerns do you have about that, if any?
I have a lot of concerns about that. And part of, so when I, and when I use the phrase tired, I'm not just talking about being tired of all the news that you're hearing, but things are like, you know, we have the income inequality, we have all of these things going on that keep people focused on their day-to-day lives, and then we're asking them to consume all this information and make an informed decision about their vote or if they need to call their congressman or whatever. So I think when I refer to being tired, I think people are just in general right now in our society, by the structure of our societies, pooped. I do think you can have, I don't know that you can have too much information, but I think you can have too much information without context. And one of the advantages, the biggest advantage of traditional media, newspapers, public radio in particular, is that it provides context. So instead of just saying, this happened today, we say, this happened today, This is a continuation of something that happened yesterday, which historically has never happened before and might not ever happen again, but this is why you should care. So I think for those of you who are active on social media, you talked about, you know, people looking more. Be their curator of facts. Help provide your friends and neighbors and the people that are on your Facebook feed with context. You know, share a Washington Post article and that's factual. Don't just share commentary or opinion that agrees with you, but just share more information. You provide some of that context because people might not get it otherwise. But I think that's one of the advantages of a free and fair press, is that it's there to provide, to put that information, to put those facts in historical context, which is the only way it really makes sense. It's the putting the roots in the ground.
First, to thank a great panel. And second, we have a short period of time to practice civil conversations. I'm going to move a little away from what the proposed question was, because I think we got some really great information. I want you as a table to imagine you need to go as a group and decide what sources would you use available to you now to be able to summarize the impeachment. As a group, I'm asking you to say, where would you go in order to get a well-rounded, objective, journalistic, accurate story summarizing the impeachment? Does that make sense?
Just one?
No. You can make a list of 20. You can you've heard some discussed here. I'm not saying what your angle on the impeachment is going to be, but as a table, I want you to agree where, what is on that list that will give you an objective story of the impeachment. Interpret it how you want. I'm trying to make it simple because we're going to give you 20 minutes and then have you report out.
Okay, we have a list of, okay, it includes NPR. People have apps on their phone for like BBC, Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, The Economist. Andy helped us with some other ones, Financial Times, RTE, which I'd never heard of, which is an Irish version of the BBC, I think he said. Okay, newstalk.com, CBC, which is Canadian, and Monocle, which I hadn't heard of. I personally I'm on Twitter a lot, and I find links to good articles by reputable institutions or journalists that I might not have known about, so I look at that, and sometimes I'll follow those links. Somebody else mentioned there's a news dissecting news informative thing called The Skim. They send out an email, is it, every day, and they provide links. It's like what's important that's going on. So they provide links to all their stuff. And then
everybody could agree to everything on that list.
Yeah, and then
you guys aren't sleeping tonight, right? You're just going to read all
right,
of
that. Right. And then there was another one I hadn't heard of called The Daily. It's a New York Times podcast that's on every morning. And I hadn't heard about that. Is that a paid thing you have to? It's free. Okay. So that's what we had.
Yeah, we were going to mention podcasts as a option. I listened to Pod Save America and some others, but there was one that someone mentioned on our table called What Trump Can Teach Us About Con Law. And it's done by a guy named Roman Mars, who interviews a constitutional law professor by the name of Elizabeth Joe. And she says it's really good and it will help explain and dissect what's going on with Donald Trump and his breaching of not just this impeachment procedure, but all the different ways he has pushed the boundaries of our Constitution. Yes, it's What Trump Can Teach Us About Con Law is the name of the podcast. Constitutional Law, it's short for constitutional law. It's by Roman Mars, M-A-R-S, does the interviewing. and he interviews Elizabeth Joh. Her name is J-O-H. Another thing that I recommend is a book called by Neil Katyal, who's a constitutional law professor at Georgetown. He's argued many cases before the Supreme Court, and he teaches a class on impeachment at Georgetown. And it's his book is called Impeachment. It just came out a couple months ago, and it has some of the source records in the back of it, but it's a very short, easy read or an audiobook. You can listen to it on audiobook as well. So the other things we mentioned were some of the comedy things besides the ones that Suzanne talked about, because, you know, things like SNL and Samantha Bee and Trevor Noah on The Daily Show and whatnot, we, you know, those are good short ways to get that information, so. And a vow, of course.
Okay, Lisa. We mentioned some of the other ones, some that others have mentioned, NPR, PBS, Reuters is a good, Reuters is a new good. The Red State, kind of get another point of view. We had talked about looking at different news sources on the right and the left and seeing if they agree and does that provide us with some fact if they both kind of agree. Newspaper commentaries that provide some context, because BBC, Washington Post, things like that. I said I use Twitter. Like I'll watch Face the Nation on Sunday mornings, and I'll get on Twitter too and just follow Face the Nation, and I get stuff from both sides, people complaining about who's talked and people who like what's talked. So it kind of helps me see what both sides are kind of saying.
There's one show at 11 o'clock on PBS called Christian and Company. That's a good one. That it has all kinds of news and obviously a lot of national.
Our group said the first thing was to have the original source to actually see what was happening or what was said. And then we liked PBS, especially the NPR and BBC parts of it, and Rachel Maddow, because there often are actual quotes, clips, etc., that you can see that are original sources. And a group of people that Kathy Hughes is the person who has pulled it together and has Tavis Smiley and Roland Martin. And that led us to discuss the fact that we probably should be finding more ethnic commentators and people who are looking at things from the point of view of different ethnicities. And we also talked about a lot of other sources, but those were the main ones.
I think we had a lot of commonality with what's been mentioned so far with NPR, the Washington Post, New York Times, the PBS NewsHour, BBC, Guardian, the DW German station, Nightly News, and Andy also added the ones that have been mentioned earlier to this, but you know, and going to the source obviously is important to see what was actually said instead of what is twisted.
I just want to say one thing. We did not talk tonight about the Russian bots that have dropped into our Facebook. Be really careful. I ran across one just today sent by my nephew, who I don't really talk to. I love the guy, but it was a bunch of numbers, percentages about immigrants, every bit of it a lie. There wasn't a piece of it that had any relevance anywhere. I looked at the bottom to see what the source was. Tumblr. So just be really careful. And these look legit. They come down your you know. But I always question him, and I always hide his because I don't want any of you that are friends on Facebook to see what he's like. But anyway.
Well, I think we've hit the end of our evening. I've written down a couple of new media sources. So there goes another 30 minutes of sleep every night that I thought I was going to get. But please, two big thank yous. One, Journal Gazette, for continuing to support for another year the activity of civil conversations. And then our panel, who just exceeded my expectations as to what we could do with this topic.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents.
Special thanks to Avow founders Patty Hayes, Rachel Tobin-Smith, Marilyn Moran Townsend, and Faith Van Gilder for organizing this event. And special thanks to Luke Hollinger and his team at Arts United for providing audio for this program. Thank you to John Dawkins for recording it. An extended version of the Q&A and conclusion of this civil conversation can be found at WBOI.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Our music is by Mark Waldick, Noah Campodonico, and Kurt Remke. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Our production assistants are Monica Blankenship and Michaela Veltum. Until next time, thank you for listening. From WBOI, Fort Wayne.